Chapter 20, section 4, we're going to be talking about achieving your financial goals. What do you want and how do you get there? You know, what's the long term for me? Retirement in 19 years. What's the short term? December kayak. Yay. So we need to think about long term and short term goals. How do we get there? Okay, so the big idea, of course, is that we are all making economic choices all of the time. We're always dealing with opportunity costs. That is the trade-off. You know, what happens if you do this thing versus this thing? If you buy the giant box of marshmallows, you don't get the nice restaurant that evening or whatever. And we are always dealing with scarcity because none of us have unlimited resources. And of course, the simple idea that economics influences all of our decisions is why this is relevant to our daily lives. And so, impulse buying is really one of the main terms that we're going to talk about today. Because if we have fixed cost, if we have non-negotiables, that is bills, then we have no control over that. You know, if my rent is $450 a month, that's $450 a month that I don't get. That goes out at the beginning of the month. As soon as I get paid, boom, that's gone. Like, I don't even have to think about that. You know, our mortgage is X amount per month, so that's a fixed cost that we deal with. What we're thinking about in terms of financial goals is the amount of money that we can control, the disposable discretionary income area. So after taxes, after bills, what do we have left? That's where we have to learn to be disciplined. And so, in thinking about this, number one, you want to think about what are your goals? What do you want someday? You know, are you wanting to set goals for this year? You know, for me, that's a kayak. Great. That's a big purchase, so it's going to take me all year to save up for it. What else? You know, is it some expensive item that you want? Well, how are you going to get there? Well, for me, that means not touching that $200 per month. And so that means as things come up where I would normally spend that money, like bike repairs or small expenses from here to here, I'm not going to touch that money. So it's going to take a little discipline. So is it lots of little things? Is that what you want? You know, do you just want that financial freedom to be able to go to the Starbucks when you want and buy the nice coffee when you want? Are you wanting to save up for a large item like me? Or are you thinking more long term? You know, pretty soon you guys are going to be living on your own. You know, when you finish early college, you'll have your 2 years of undergraduate, but then hopefully you're going to move on and go to some university. And that's going to mean dorm room, food, lodging, living expenses, whatever. And let's say you have all that taken care of. Let's say room and board and tuition are taken care of, which is amazing. And seriously, kudos if that happens. But the reality is, you're still going to need money to live on. Possibly for one semester, as much as $1,000, just to get you through the semester. And that's assuming that you still have room and board. You're going to need $1,000 for things like gas, emergencies, going out to eat with friends, doing fun things. If you want to have any type of entertainment cost, you need to have about $1,000 per semester. And that's still assuming that you have room, board, tuition covered. So where's that $1,000 a semester going to come from? Well, number one, you got to set that goal, that to have that money. Because otherwise, it's no fun to be in college and go, I can't hang out with you guys. I'm broke as a joke. And then before long, like, people stop asking you to do things. So you want to have that money. So saving for college is not just tuition, because that's a huge number. That may be impossible in the jobs you have right now. But in addition to applying for scholarships, etc., getting student loans, etc., maybe that could be your goal, is covering your living expenses while you're there. Not having to work, which would be amazing. Not having to work while you're in college, being able to focus solely on classes and social life. So, what kind of spender? You know, again, we're dealing with discretionary income. So now that you have, say, $500 a month in discretionary income, which would be pretty amazing at your age, but let's say that's what you're working with. So now you have to think about, what kind of spender are you? You know, what kinds of pitfalls can you run into? You know, is McDonald's going to be a temptation? And is that going to eat into that $1,000 that you're trying to save up? You know, is Starbucks a temptation. Once more, how do you avoid these types of pitfalls to reach your goals? So setting goals is the first step. It really is. You know, what do you want? If you have no financial goals, if you're like, I'm happy, I just prefer to live month to month, and that's great, that's great. If your goal is a zero balance at the end of each month, that's awesome. But still, is that how you want to be for the rest of your life? Zero balance end of each month. There are going to be big ticket items that you need to think long and short term for. And so a couple things that can help you reach that. Number one, evaluate your spending. There's an excellent app called Mint. Mint is a handy little app. No longer do you have to keep long detailed written spreadsheets. Mint will do all this work for you. You give it access to your bank account, which is kind of something you have to think about before you give it that type of access. Well, it evaluates your spending. It tracks every purchase item that you make as long as you're using a debit or credit card. And it helps you to evaluate. It puts it on a spreadsheet like, whoa, you spent $50 at Starbucks this month. Whoa, you spent $150 at restaurants this month. And it'll show you all that on a little graph. And so again, that helps you to evaluate, where's your money going? To what degree can you control that? And so of course the concern is impulse buy. It doesn't have to be a concern. It could be something that you call fun, but it's things that you didn't intend to buy. And so it's money that you didn't intend to spend. So ergo, it's money that you don't have that you weren't planning to not have. And so impulse buy is the purchasing of an item on the spot because of an emotional rather than a planned decision. Once more, we are all guilty of this. But when thinking about financial goals, we're thinking about the money that we can control. You know, let's say, for example, I'm dealing with about $550 a month of discretionary income, but from that comes gas. From that comes going out to eat, any other fun purchase items that I make per month. That's with a career type job, so that's about what I'm working with. So every time I go to the store, I'm thinking that's coming out of discretionary income. Anytime I want something, that's coming out of that pot of discretionary income. And that thing that I buy means something else later the month that I can't have. And so since you're dealing with limited resources, you have to make value-based decisions. Impulse buying is not always value-based. It's emotional-based. That's why it's something that your book and I try to caution you against. You know, for example, discipline means trying not to buy something too quickly. Let's say you want something. I do this all the time. I want something. I see it as I'm scrolling through Amazon or as I'm looking through social media. An ad pops up because, of course, ads these days are clever and they're targeted directly to what I like and what I search for. So an ad comes up for something that I probably want. Well, I don't know if any of you guys do this. Amazon has the great little wish list feature, or the save and track feature. So you can save an item on there, that way it's there, easy to find if you want to see it later, and it will also track if there's a price drop. And so you can give it a couple weeks, you can add it to that, give it some time, and come back later and see if you still want it. Of course, some impulse buying's fine. You know, okay, so you want to go to McDonald's after, like $5 is not going to break the bank, but $5 does add up over time. So that's where, in moderation, impulse buying can be just fine. Again, too much of it. The really scary thing is when you exhaust the discretionary pot of money and you start having to dig into other pots. That's where things get a little concerning. And so setting up some guidelines for yourself can help you to avoid common pitfalls. Now, there's a lot of ways this happens. You know, in stores, when you're in the checkout line, you know there's lots of stuff just staring at you. And it's all cheap. It's like a dollar or two. What, you want some Twizzlers? That's my personal favorite. Like, oh man, there's always Twizzlers at the checkout line. It's a weakness. Oh, you know, there's some new silly magazine, okay? Like, you hadn't thought about that magazine in months, but now you see it, and you're like, oh, yeah, catchy title. Or maybe it's just some candy. You know, maybe it's like, my wife loves Skittles. Like, she has a hard time going to the grocery store and not buying herself a bag of Skittles. She just likes them, whatever. You know, it's something, it's an impulse buy that she sees and she buys, okay? So, how do you recognize impulse buying for what it is? Number one, is it a need? Is it a want? You know, could you live without it? Well, there's also quality of life to consider. You know, if you had to go your whole life and not eat Skittles, like, that's kind of a sad life. Like, there's nothing wrong with eating Skittles, like, in and of itself. Are you buying it to make you feel better? You know, like, can't tell you how many times I've been in a store and I see like something simple like candy and I'm like, ooh, okay, I want that. Or maybe I'm just scrolling through Amazon and I'm like, ooh, I want this thing. And I start obsessing about that thing, right? And before long, that thing becomes equated with happiness and I want that thing. Now again, in and of itself, it's not terrible. But you have to learn how to do this responsibly versus letting it control you. Because purchasing items can be an addiction just like anything else. Okay. Here's where it gets really scary. When you find yourself in the hole because you've spent too much money that month. You know, right now, you guys should be learning how to do this. And hopefully your parents are helping you with that process. Because when you find yourself in a situation where you're spending more money than you're making each month, you're racking up lots and lots of debt. You know, my first experience with this, you know, as a grown-up, was my first year of teaching. It was the first year that I got decent money. I was like, whoa, this is, it's not a lot, but like for me it was a lot. Coming from working mostly, you know, 10 bucks an hour was the most I'd ever made prior to becoming a teacher. And so getting like a salaried position was a really big deal. But guess what? Even by the end of the first month, I was broke as a joke. By the second month, still broke as a joke. What did I do first month? I went out and bought the fanciest iPod because I mean, it was 2007. They didn't have, well, they had iPhones, but no one really used them. I went out and bought a really nice iPod. The 80 gig video iPod was the latest and greatest in 2007. First month, I mean, ugh. Second month, what did I do? I bought an Xbox 360. I'm an idiot. So those were two huge purchases that just immediately limited my discretionary income. And so my thought was, okay, whatever, I'll eat cheap for the rest of the month. I just really want that Xbox. I really want that iPod. What did I do the third month? I bought a brand new car. Okay, yeah, I mean, the idiot meter was really going up there. But hey, this was my first time having real stuff. I wanted the nice things. And so I locked myself into a $585 a month four-year contract. $585 a month is a lot of money, ladies and gentlemen. And I paid it. Oh, my gosh. I paid it. But I'm just telling you from life experience, it's one thing to like hear it in a classroom. It's another to have to live through it. And then when you get to the point where you can't pay your bills, those are the subjects of nervous breakdowns. Like when your credit score starts plummeting because you can't pay your monthly bills, it's a scary position to be in. And so when you buy things, now's the best time to practice because you're dealing with money that your parents have decided they can live without and so they're giving it to you. Or you're earning that money through a job or through allowance. Bottom line, your parents are probably still going to keep you alive even if you run out of the money in your savings. So it's a great time to practice this. So when you buy something, think about how long is it going to sustain your interest? You know, how long is that thing going to keep you happy? You know, that cup of coffee that costs $5, is it worth it? And that's the big question. So, impulse buying has its place. Because, I mean, after all, you're going to spend money and it's going to make you happy. And if that's the thing you want that day, great. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. But again, if it's hindering your financial goals, that's where it's a problem. And so next we need to think about how do we make careful buying decisions. Number one, what are your goals? You know, what is your goal when you're buying this thing? Is it temporary? Is it long-term? You know, do you have any long-term goals? Do you have any short-term goals? You know, long-term for me is retirement. That's a big one, right? 19 years from now, I will be retired from this job. And that means that for the rest of my life, I'll get half pay, which is pretty incredible. And I'm really excited about that. That's not enough to live on. I'll still have to get a second career, but that's a long-term goal that I'm already getting excited about. What's a short-term goal? Again, short-term goal is the kayak. It's not going to save the world for me, but for me, it's something I want, so I'm saving up for it. So I need to balance long-term goals with short-term goals, just like you guys do too. So long-term planning for you might simply be saving up for living expenses when you get to college. Because let's be honest, your first year of college might be largely paid for. You might be super motivated. Miss Willingham will start to talk to you about scholarships, and that's something you should already be considering. Financial aid, already you should be considering that. So your tuition, your room and board, and your housing. These are things that you might not be able to save up for feasibly at this time. But realistically, this summer, you could work your tail off and you could save up and go into college with a little money in your bank account. And I do highly recommend that. And that's a realistic long-term goal for you guys. Okay. Now, short-term spending. Can make it difficult to achieve long-term goals. You know, when I was your age, I bought my first vehicle. It was a Ford Ranger 1991 pickup truck. I mean, that was in 1998, so it was still an older model even when I got it. Well, it had about 100,000 miles on it. It was in decent shape, and it only cost me like $2,000, so it wasn't really expensive. But even that $2,000 took me an entire summer to pay for. So out of every paycheck, I was dedicated. Every paycheck, every 2 weeks, $100 went directly to my truck. The rest went to pay for gas and living expenses while I was saving up. So $100 every 2 weeks for this truck. And that was my commitment, and I stuck to it and I paid off the truck. So that was my goal. Now, here's the thing. Any time where I was spending too much, going out to eat, seeing friends, I was obsessed with going to the movies back then, so that could threaten that $100 every 2 weeks. So that's where it would have gotten dangerous. So it wasn't simple. At the end of the day, I got my truck. So you got to think about, what are your goals? So the big idea in Chapter 20, Section 2 about planning and budgeting is, once more, we have to make economic choices dealing with scarcity. Terms that we'll see, such as budget, income, expense, credit, APR, collateral, and bankruptcy, all have to do with individual finance, something that you should all become familiar with and hopefully we can learn about this section. So I already asked you guys about budget. You know, your bank account, as you start using a bank, will keep a record of all of your spendings and all of your earnings, all the money coming in, all of the money coming out. I love it. It's on my phone, shows me a simple spreadsheet I can understand very easily. The only difference between what I'm seeing on my phone and a checkbook is, with a checkbook, you fill out each purchase at the time of the purchase. You fill out each income at the time of the receipt of that. So it's a little more current than what you would see on a bank account. And so that's why people are still encouraged to keep a record, an actual written record in a checkbook of your transactions. Okay, so what does making a budget look like? And what does following it look like? A budget, really, is just a plan. A plan for how you're going to make money and how you're going to spend money. And at the very least, I would advise you all come up with a plan. It doesn't have to be a meticulous record of all transactions forever, but you need to have some general plan of how much money you're going to make each month, what are your fixed costs, what are your variable costs, what's your discretionary income versus your disposable income. If you know those four things and how to work those four things, you can come up with a basic plan for your budget. Okay, so basic budgeting terms. Number one is simply income. Income is the money you received. It can be from labor, it can be from a gift, it can be whatever. Any money coming in, ergo, it's called income. Secondly, expenses. You need to understand expenses. That is money going out. You know, and again, expenses are lumped. That could be bills, it could be restaurants, it could be we're going to El Chapala for dinner. Great. You know, that's part of our expenses. It's everything, the money you're spending. And then finally, the balance. That is the money left over. Now, some of you guys are doing weekly budgets because you're paid on Friday. Some of you do bi-weekly because you're paid every 2 weeks. We do a monthly budget because we're paid at the end of each month. And so we have to think about how we're going to spend money for the entire month. So people do it different ways. But once more, the balance is any money left over at the end of the month. Ideally, it is a surplus. That means that you're making more money than you spend each month. There's a lot you can do with surplus. Me, you know, I tend to be a little more materialistic. I'm like, yay, I have a surplus this month. There's this thing I was wanting to buy. Woo, yay. Or yay, I have a surplus this month. I'm going to get my bike fixed. You know, or yay, surplus this month. I'm going to go out, let's go see a movie or something. Unfortunately, I've certainly been in the situation of having a deficit. You know, like when we were first married, money was really tight. And she was still in grad school, and I still had a car payment. We were struggling to make ends meet. And so that's obviously bad. So how do you make a budget? What do you need in order to have a budget? First off, you need to understand what are you going to spend. That's where fixed costs, variable costs, discretionary, disposable. You know, what are your fixed costs? What things are you going to have to spend money on, non-negotiable? You know, right now, are you paying for your cell phone? Is that part of your monthly budget or weekly budget? So is that something you have to account for? Are you paying for any gas if you're driving? Is that something you have to think about? So about how much gas are you using per month? For me, since I've got a commute, it's about $150 a month. I know off the top, $150 a month is going to go to gas. It's a lot, believe me. And then finally, I'm going to record what I earn. I need to be aware of how much money I'm making each month. I know the exact number after taxes. And we watch it closely. When we get a little more each month, that's great. When we get a little less, that's not so great. You know, really the big variable there often comes down to what are the healthcare costs each year. Those insurance rates often go up each year. And energy rates often also go up each year. So for example, where we were paying $100 a month for energy, now we're looking at about $108, which $8 a month doesn't sound like a lot, but you have to be aware of every little piece of where that money's going. And then finally, you have to analyze that data. You know, I'm an Excel fan. I like spreadsheets. She does too. We can look at that and we can analyze very easily. Okay, how much is going to this each month? How much is going to this each month? Is this one changing? Is this one changing? And then finally, you want to have a surplus. That's the idea. The better a plan you have and the more disciplined you are in following it, the idea is that you have money left over at the end of each month, that you are in control of your wallet, not the other way around. And this involves monitoring spending closely. You know, hopefully it's easy at your age, where you're not making a ton of money and you're not having to spend a ton of money, and you can learn that way. And we plan on teaching our kid that way by giving them an allowance that they have to earn in some way so that they hold value to it, and then teaching them how to budget with that so that they can learn how to spend their money carefully, how to be aware of where their money's going, and how to hopefully be able to save up for the big things they want. Now, I'm notorious for this. I'm always scheming for ways to raise my income. You know, is there a second job I can take on? I'm always applying for at least one other third job. You know, just got feelers out there, resumes out there for online positions all over the place. Why? Because I'm a big fan of increasing revenue, because that's awesome. That means more fun stuff. Like, I'm always scheming to how can I find ways to increase my outdoor account, because that's my fun account. Like, how can I, you know, take more trips? How can I buy more cool things that I want versus, you know, just having to deal with the necessities? So that's me. I like to always think about increasing revenue, whereas my wife is better at cutting cost, at thinking like, how can we be more disciplined with our budget? So again, it's just two schools of thought. Next, you need to understand credit. I think that when you become an adult, you will want to, and you will really need to, establish a line of credit. But it's a very careful decision that you need to make, and it's something that you need to do with a bit of foreknowledge. So, credit's credit, that is borrowing money to pay for items or services, allows consumers to have whatever good or service that you need or want ahead of your ability to pay for it outright. Now, establishing a line of credit is very important, because someday you're going to need to rent an apartment. Maybe sooner rather than later, I don't know. Maybe one of your friends here at the school, you and your friend, your plan after early college is to rent an apartment together. That's wonderful. Hopefully you have parents that can co-sign for you. Because what the person renting the apartment to you needs to know is that you are dependable. And a credit history shows on paper that you are dependable, that you can make payments in a timely fashion, and that you can handle the responsibility of a monthly bill. Because right now, if you have never had a credit card, you have no way to prove that. Now, hopefully you have parents who have good credit, who can establish good faith and can show on paper that they can pay their bills on time. But if you don't, and you don't have parents with good credit, that's something you just need to carefully begin to think about. So again, a few terms you need to know in regards to credit. Number one is the lender. So let's say you get a credit card through Discover. We're fans of Discover because, you know, once you have a good credit rating, they have a low interest rate. So it's a 5% fixed interest rate that we have through Discover. So Discover is our lender. A lender charges interest. The term that you need to know for interest is APR, or annual percentage rate. That means the annual cost of credit as a percentage of the amount borrowed. Lots of people run their budgets in different ways. Some people use credit cards for everything and pay the balance at the end of the month, and they get rewards that way. Our personal preference is to not touch the credit card. We have it literally frozen in the freezer. It's kind of a silly symbolic thing, but we were pretty proud when we got our credit card balance paid off, and we stuck it in a piece of Tupperware, we poured water on it, and we put it in the freezer. And so now if we need the credit card, we actually have to go and thaw it out. It makes us think about whatever credit decision we're going to use for a day or two while it thaws out. So again, credit cards are a valuable thing because our credit rating is strong, because to my knowledge, we've never missed a payment on a bill in the time that we've been married. And I don't think I've ever missed a payment in my life on anything. So that gives us a strong credit rating, meaning that when we went to buy our house, that was not an issue. They looked at our credit rating. They were like, okay, you guys are good to go on that piece. Okay. Now, a credit rating, I've already mentioned, evaluates how well the borrower will repay the loan. There's a lot that goes into a credit score. If you have a strong credit score, then if I'm going to rent you a house, a strong credit score is a good sign. That means you have a stable job. That means you have a history of paying your bills on time. That means you're probably somebody I can trust, and I would be more likely to say, sure, you can rent my house for the summer. I'm traveling, so why not? I'm more likely to do that as opposed to if you have a low credit score, that means you've missed a payment from time to time. What am I supposed to do if you can't pay your rent? That's a problem. You know, if you're renting my house and you can't pay your rent, that's a problem. I don't want to have to deal with that problem. That's a super big headache. You know, do I have to call the police to evict you? Oh my gosh, it's a mess. You might destroy my property if you're getting evicted. Like, Had friends who've done that. No. So again, if you have a strong credit rating, awesome. If not, hopefully your parents will co-sign for you someday. If not,
your other option is collateral. Now, the lender may or may not accept collateral, but collateral is property or valuable items serving as security for a loan. So I've done this before. I don't know if you ever have. Like, you bought an item in a store and you forgot your wallet. I've been there. I'm like at the register, like, oh, this is embarrassing. Let me go grab my wallet. If it's something really valuable, then you might try to say, and it's probably not going to work, but you say, tell you what, I'll be right back. I'll leave my cell phone with you. I'll be right back. You know, in a way, what you're doing is leaving collateral. You're saying, I'm not going to run off without my cell phone. So here, hold on to this. I'll be right back. You know, that's a version of collateral. You can pledge collateral legally. That is when we borrowed money to buy our house. Our house is the collateral. If we can't pay the mortgage, we lose the house, bottom line. It's the same with the car. So we borrowed money for the car. We can't pay the car. A remortgage is another version of this. So you're borrowing money off the value of your house. Credit. So sources of credit usually require some form of down payment. This is another good faith offering. So let's say that you're going to get a bike on installment. So when I first got my mountain bike, I couldn't afford it outright. This was a lot of money, so I got it on installment. That means that I'm making payments toward it. Well, I had to make a down payment first. And so it was like a $500 down payment, and then I can make payments each month on it. And that's a form of credit. Banks, savings and loans, credit unions, finance companies offer credit. You can get it from a lot of different places. The bank is probably the most reliable, but also credit cards are the most convenient. Okay, other sources of credit. The most common, of course, are credit cards. You know, let's say, you know, I get to the point where I can't continue to fix my boat. I mean, I've had these before where they break so badly they basically won't float anymore. I can't fix them. Like, they won't make it down a river. I just sink. At that point, with my interest, it becomes a necessity to me to have a boat. And so I have bought one on a credit card before. It is kind of a scary position to be in. So I bought the boat on a credit card, and then I paid it off over time. My goal, of course, since we're very conservative with our finances, is to pay it off quickly, so as quickly as I can. But that is, we used a credit card to charge or borrow the money to pay for an item. And that means that I now have a monthly payment. Now, for example, my cell phone, I don't know, I can't say that I bought the cheapest phone. I bought a nice phone. It was a Google Pixel. Probably didn't need one that nice, but I did. Anyway, I wanted the one with 120 gigabytes of storage, and I wanted the 2-year warranty, so it wound up costing a pretty penny. Well, it was a little more than I had in cash, so I got this on installment. I've had it for about a year and a half now. I'm still making payments on the silly phone. Well, it's about 30 bucks a month, zero interest. I can live with that, so I'm making payments even on the phone I've got. That's a form of credit. Now, what you need to be careful about is that credit cards can charge high interest rates. The only reason I got this phone versus whatever cheapest Android phone there was because it was a zero interest rate. I knew that even though I'm paying for this over 2 years, I'm not having to pay any extra. But now, had I just ran this on Discover, I would be paying the cost of this phone plus 5% interest, which is recalculated annually, meaning compounding annually. So if I don't pay it off at a certain point, it's going to be even more than 5%. So that's where the fine print on credit cards comes in. You can wind up paying significantly more for something if you pay it over the course of a long period of time. So benefits of credit. Number one, the obvious. It allows you to get what you want sooner. Had I tried to save up for this phone, I mean, it would take forever. It would already be obsolete by the time they've already stopped selling the Pixels. So I wouldn't have been able to save up for the Pixel. So I got it, yay. It also teaches financial discipline, because I'm paying for this out of my second job, so I got to keep that second job. That means I got to drag myself to work on a Wednesday night every Wednesday. So I guess it keeps me disciplined to a point. Like, this means I have to go work every Wednesday night. I don't really feel like it, but I have to. So there you go. Teaches me discipline. The drawbacks. And this is something you need to think very carefully about before you use credit. Of course, you could wind up spending more than you can afford. And this means bankruptcy, and this is a very scary situation to be in. Bankruptcy means the inability to pay your debt. You are legally allowed to declare personal bankruptcy once per life. You gotta wait for the next life to get the next one. But once per life, you may declare bankruptcy. And what that means is that all your debts are absolved. Your credit history goes to zero and remains at zero for 7 years. That means no one's going to loan you money, no one's going to touch you. You're going to have trouble renting an apartment unless someone will co-sign for you. So good luck finding a place to live. Good luck getting even a car. You're going to have to pay cash for those things, but you get that one-time bailout. And that's not a good situation. My goal in life is to never find myself in that situation. Another drawback. Let's say, you know, that's the extreme is bankruptcy. But let's just say you miss a payment. I have to be honest, I did find myself in this situation one time where I had a surgery and I had some high medical bills. In the first month of adjusting to those medical bills, I had to call up Chase Bank, who owned my car loan, and I had to say, is there a way I can skip a payment? And, oh man, you should have heard her over the phone. She was like, what do you mean? Like, I said, can I take a month off from car payments? And she said, well, you know, so she gave me an education on how debt works. And she said, it doesn't work like that. And I was like, well, what happens if I miss a payment? And she said, well, there's a strike on your credit score. There's gonna be interest on that missed payment. Basically, you're gonna have to pay for the car longer. And so we had to weigh that decision as a couple, and we had to agree, okay, dang it, we got to miss a payment that month. Lesson learned, it was not a good situation, and that actually did hurt our credit rating a little bit. So, even the borrowers have responsibilities. So, if you're going to borrow money, you need to have a plan of how to get it paid for. You know, in my case of the phone, it was just, okay, $30 a month, I'll deduct that from my Blue Ridge income. Fair enough. Yeah. That's going to require some skills in budgeting. Because for us, you know, $30 a month is really not a lot in the scheme of things because we have a mortgage. That's a lot every month. We have a baby coming. That's a lot. You know, we have cars that are getting older that we're having to repair a lot. I mean, I've got to go to the shop during fourth period to get a stupid tire fixed. I mean, there's always something going on. So we have a sinking fund for cars. So we have all of these other budgeting items that require quite a bit of skill to manage. And finally, if you're going to borrow money, and I'm telling you, it's something that you'll need to do at some point, you need to read the fine print. That is, what's the interest rate? What are the penalties for a missed payment? What is your credit score? How does this relate to your credit score? You know, what's the minimum payment versus, you know, how much is going to principal, how much is going to interest? Like, educate yourself about all these financial terms. And then finally, should credit be hard to maintain? And this is a two-edged sword too, because you guys need to establish a line of credit. So thankfully, credit right now is easy to obtain, but it comes with that responsibility to be careful. Talking about chapter 20, section 1, one of my favorite chapters on personal finance. I think it's such an important and relevant subject that we need to learn about. And so the big idea here is that you and everyone around you are consumers, and that you are one of the most vital and important parts of our economy. We'll see. Of course, consumer, that's you, that's me. Disposable income, that's the fun part of money. Discretionary income, once more, a little more flexible, but we'll get into those definitions. What is consumerism? What is our obsession with stuff? Comparison shopping, which we all do, and then finally, warranty. So one of my favorites, when you buy something, hopefully it has a good warranty. So the big question, of course, do you think? Are the rights of consumers more important than the rights of producers and sellers? Both have rights. And that's why when you buy something very expensive, if you're counting on a warranty, you need to read the fine print before you buy the item. For example, my mountain bike that I spent too much money on has a 5-year warranty on the frame, but that excludes dropping it off a building. If through natural use the frame cracks, which sometimes they do, they will replace it. But if it cracks because I drop it off a building or throw it out of a car or jump off a huge thing and crash and break every bone in my body, including the bike, well, that's not covered. But normal use, once more covered. That's in the fine print that I also read before I bought the bike. So that's a right that I have as a consumer. Now, as a seller, they have a right to review that. So it goes. Now, consumer rights. To make good economic decisions as consumers, we have to be aware of our rights and our responsibilities. First off, a consumer is someone who buys a good or service, which, as you can see, is everyone. We all buy a good or a service at some point. And we do have rights in the free enterprise system. We have two types of income to spend. Number one is disposable income. This is the money left after taxes on it have been paid. This is different than discretionary income. Discretionary income is the money left after bills have been paid. So once more, disposable income is my net income after taxes, meaning this is what I have to pay my mortgage, my car payment, the baby payment, whatever it costs to birth that thing, and all of that. That's where bills go from. Discretionary income, that's the fun part. That's the money left after necessities have been bought and paid for. So that's excluding if you have sinking funds, say you've got a gas account, say I know that I spend about $150 a month on gas. That's roughly my gas budget for the month. So after that, I have about $400 a month to go out to eat. Like that's our dining, you know, that's part of our discretionary income that we don't have to do that, but we can. So this is the fun money after the bills have been paid. So maybe this is what you choose as your movie budget. Like maybe that's your thing. You love going to see all the movies in the theaters, and so you want to budget for that. This is where that money comes in. You know, you've already fed yourself, you've taken care of medical bills, all things have been paid. Now here's what you have left to do fun things with. You know, and this is kind of a motivator for a lot of people to get good paying jobs so they have more discretionary income. After all, we are a society based on consumerism. That means that we like stuff. We like to have stuff, the nice things. You know, we want the MacBook Pros versus the Chromebooks because it's just cool. Or we want the nice mountain bike or the nice car because that's what we like. And there's nothing wrong with that. But we need to be educated as consumers about the purchases we make. And if you're like me, when it comes to spending money on fun things, I obsess. I read all the reviews. I talk to a million people. What should I buy? I know already which kayak I want to buy. I'll have enough money by December. And so I'm already thinking and obsessing about it. But what's important is we also need to think about the things that are not as exciting. Like to me, buying a new kayak is really exciting. Like that's a fun thing. But it's not as fun to think about what kind of car seat I need for my baby. Like, okay, that's not as exciting, but it's important. I need a safe car seat. I need a good one that's going to work and last. You know, it's not as exciting to think about you know, how are we going to pay for medical bills? You know, once more, that's not fun,
but it's important.
Because as consumers, once more, we need to be educated. Because after all, there are laws that protect us as consumers. You know, you have a right to understand and be aware of what you're putting in your body. And that's why restaurants and grocery stores and food manufacturers are required to disclose what's in their products by law as per the Pure Food and Drug Act. But even private businesses have rights. And you have rights as a consumer of private businesses. For example, if you feel cheated by a business, you can contact the Better Business Bureau. They are an advocacy group which represents your interest as a consumer. Now, the Consumer Bill of Rights. What you can expect from someone that you purchase a product from. And if these rights are violated, then you certainly have the right to contact the Better Business Bureau. For example, you have the right to a safe product. You know, this summer I was on my way back from Colorado, a tire blew on the interstate. It's a really scary situation when that happens. But luckily I was going slowly enough and driving carefully enough that I was able to safely get off of the interstate, put a spare tire on, and drive slowly and carefully to the nearest auto shop. I happened to be near Nashville, Tennessee, and so I got on my phone and I called my parents and I looked up like what a good place to buy tires from. Now, I made a poor decision as a consumer. I bought used tires. Just friendly advice, don't ever buy used tires. It's something you always should buy new. Well, I bought used tires and they did not balance them for me. I just assumed that was something that they would do, but they did not. And so that means that my car was wobbling all the way home, like 200 miles home. It was very dangerous and scary to drive unbalanced tires. It also means that one of the tires that I bought had a slow leak in the sidewall. Now, me being cheap and stubborn, I applied AquaSeal or some type of putty, like epoxy, to the sidewall. And I thought, yay, problem solved. I found the leak. I used epoxy. I talked to several people about it. They were like, that's really unsafe. You don't need to do that. It's going to explode and get you really hurt. So lesson learned, don't ever buy used tires. So I have a right to a safe product, though, as a consumer. So I called up the place where I bought the used tires from. And I said, you guys sold me a tire with a leak in the sidewall. It's unsafe. I can't use it. And even though it was a used product, he said, tell you what, bring it back and I'll replace it for you. Well, unfortunately, that was a 500-mile round trip to go back. So I said, I can't do that. You know, you're 5 hours away from me. That's one way, 5 hours. I was like, I can't do that. And he just said, well, then I can't help you. And to be honest, he was right. He was within his rights to say that's the end of it, because how am I to prove anything different? So I also have a right to be informed about my product. As a responsible consumer, I should have checked the tires before I left. As soon as I saw it was wobbling, I should have turned right around and drove back. I have a right to be informed about my product. I certainly could have asked them more about what they were doing. Even though I sat and watched them, I still missed the fact that he didn't balance them, and I certainly missed the fact that there was a leak in the sidewall. And I have a right to choose. To be honest, I didn't have to go to the used place. I was being cheap. I shouldn't have. I should have known better. There was a perfectly good new car store right across the parking lot. The other side of the mall, wherever I stopped, there was a perfectly good new Firestone tire place. I should have chose them. But I had a right to choose, and I made a poor decision, because that's the responsibility that goes along with the right. Finally, I have a right to be heard. Now, in that case, they were within their rights. I wasn't cheated. It was just a poor decision on my part. Were I cheated, then I certainly have a right to be heard. Oh my gosh. And there are agencies who have the responsibility to correct injustices, because after all, I have a right to redress. meaning that if a business cheats me, then I can contact the Better Business Bureau. I can go to local media outlets. I can seek justice, even if they've not committed a crime against me. If they have violated my rights as a consumer, then absolutely, I have rights. Okay, so how are these rights protected? You know, that's where it gets tricky. You know, is it criminal law, is it civil law? And that's where, like, who should be the agency that defends me? And it will most commonly have to be you. You know, the Better Business Bureau isn't looking after Sophia going, "Hi, Sophia, just wanted to call to see if your consumer rights have been protected today." No, that's not their job. She has to be an advocate for herself and defend herself and be prepared to read the fine print and deal with whatever she has to do to get her rights protected. Now, what responsibilities do we have as consumers? Because you see, after all, if we have these rights, that also means we have responsibilities. We have to utilize smart buying strategies. That is, we should gather information about whatever we're going to buy. You know, I tend to prefer to spend a little extra money for the higher quality product on a big purchase. Of course, I don't always make the smart decisions on smaller purchases, and I should. So gathering information is an extremely important step in making financial decisions. Secondly, utilize advertising carefully. You know, what is the source of your information? It's just like making political decisions. Consider the source of the information. You know, when Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, we were talking about that in American History. The chemical companies that produced the pesticides that she was talking about said, "Oh no, our pesticides are fine." Well, that was what their advertising said. Our pesticides don't hurt anybody. Well, consider the source, because the science confirmed that in fact DDT does harm us. Now, think of cigarette companies. The big tobacco manufacturers lost a lawsuit about 15 years ago, and that lawsuit required them to disclose information about how their product can cause cancer. And that was the result of a decades-long case where big tobacco did not want to have to put that label on their product, but now they do. And then finally, you have to determine the best value. Well, unfortunately, value doesn't always mean price. You know, what does value mean? Well, you could buy a car out of a junkyard for $500, and it may get you killed when the engine catches on fire. Been there, done that. I had a Peugeot. It's an old French car, and it caught on fire on me. Twice. Because I was too stubborn. I was too stubborn to dispose of it, and I was too cheap to be able to do anything about it. So the first time I stopped, I put out the fire, I continued. It also had a sticky gas pedal, meaning that if you floored it, it would get stuck with the pedal on the floor. And so I had to do a few emergency stops at 105 miles an hour. I'll tell you what, that's scary. Where I had it floored and then it wouldn't unfloor. I even tried with my foot to like grab it, but you're going 105 miles an hour and that's deadly. And so I had to turn off the ignition, force it off the road, which is not a good situation. Anyway, so value is not always price. You have to think very carefully, what does value mean to you? And after all, comparison shop. You know, that's why I had you do the project about the car, because the car is one of the bigger, more important decisions that you're going to make in the next year. And so hopefully you did a lot of good comparison shopping. That is, the best product for the best price. But once more, best, that's a subjective term. What does best mean to you? That may mean you're perfectly satisfied with a safe clunker. As long as it runs, that's all you need. Best to you may mean fancy new car. And hey, if that's something you place a high value on, that's you. But just make sure that you do that as an educated decision instead of an impulse. Because after all, there's no agency out there to say, "Oh, I'm sorry you made a poor purchase decision. Pat, pat, pat. We're going to take care of that for you." That's not how life works. You know, we had a student who spent too much on the DC trip and unfortunately ran out of money. And we took care of it since, you know, we're kind of like your parents. But that person got in some trouble because, after all, they made some poor decisions. And Ms. Cottle tried to take the student to the stores that they had bought the items from. And the store said, no, we don't do returns. Do you see the sign on the front? Can't help you, sorry. You know, and that was just a poor decision that person made. Life lesson, hopefully. Can't say we'll never do it, right? So when we're buying things, we have to look at a number of items. Is it brand name versus generic? Is that important to you? Is that important to the quality of the product? For me, name brand mac and cheese, that's important. Because off-brand mac and cheese doesn't taste right. That's just me. However, it may not be important to you. But when it comes to coffee, no offense, Bryce, I buy the cheap stuff. Because, well, coffee's coffee. I love it. I do go for the fancy stuff every now and then. But for my daily intake, which we're looking at that giant mug over there, daily intake, the cheap stuff's fine. But again, what does value mean to you? Is it name brand? Is it generic? What are the costs? What are the benefits? You know, because after all, there are certain items that I do certainly only buy name brand for. And there are some that I only buy generic for. There are some other responsibilities that I have as a consumer. If you are making a big purchase, it is essential that you keep any warranty information. I'd like to say I'm somewhat of an expert on this. I've dealt with warranty issues with my kayaks. I've dealt with warranty issues with my mountain bike, with my car. You just need to be good at this. This is something that is part of being a grown-up making big decisions, is that you keep warranty information, you read the fine print on the big products that you purchase, and you understand what rights you have as a buyer, but that also you respect the rights that you have as a seller. You know, for example, REI used to have a policy that they would return any item, no question, forever. It's a pretty sweet policy. Like, you could have a 10-year-old backpack, get sick of it one day, it's been in your closet forever, and you could take it back to them and they would give you full price. Now, imagine the problems that arose from that. They eventually changed the policy to now it is a 1-year policy. You have 1 year to bring an item back, no questions asked. People still abuse that. And so, unfortunately, we have to consider human nature, that we're all cheap and that we're all going to look for ways to scheme. And we do have to respect the rights of certain businesses. You know, if you buy a pair of shoes and they last you a year, that's fair. If you buy a pair of shoes and they last you 5 months, then maybe that's on them. You know, unless you like running around in fires or something. Like, unless you just like destroying things, like a pair of shoes should probably last more than 5 months. But you should be satisfied if they last a year, and that's fair. So you have to be reasonable when dealing with sellers also. But now, if you don't report problems, they're never gonna get solved. If you don't advocate for yourself, other people aren't going to advocate for you. You know, right now, your parents, your teachers, your adults in your life are hopefully advocates for you. But you can't always count on that. And you probably can't always count on that now. You have to advocate for yourself. Other responsibilities. So what happens if you buy a really fancy backpack, talking like the $300 model? Do you know, by the way, they sell bulletproof backpacks now in response to the school shootings? That is something that is a thing. So it's a $300 backpack. You can buy it. It's bulletproof. You can apparently shoot an assault rifle at it, and it will stop the bullet. So let's say you bug your parents and go, man, I really need this $300 backpack to make me feel safer. Okay, well, as a parent, If that's something, you know, that's going to get you through the day, then we'll figure out how to make it happen. So you got your $300 backpack. You're telling all your friends, I'm bulletproof now. Check this thing out. Yay, you know. And then Alan's like, no way, that's not bulletproof. Bet you it is. $5. All right, cool. Well, I've got an AR-15 at home. Let's go test it out. Sweet. So, you know, you go home. I don't own an AR. I do not. But let's say Alan does fictionally. So you go test this thing out. You pull out your AR-15. You shoot the backpack. Boom, you know. Hole goes right through it. Well, that's a problem, right? that is a real problem. And it is the company's responsibility to make that right. Okay, so how are you going to make it right? Well, you're not just going to sit there. You know, they're not going to magically contact you and say, hey, Becky, I heard you bought one of our backpacks. I just wanted to see how it's working for you. Did you test it out? Is it bulletproof? Do we need to replace it? No, that's not their job. Your job is, number one, report the problem. Look up the manufacturer. Okay, L.L. Bean made the bulletproof backpack. Awesome. Contact L.L. Bean. If you find yourself in the warranty process, do not attempt to fix the product for yourself. This is very important. Until you have clearly documented it. So I just broke my 7th kayak in 7 years, guys, yesterday. It was a bummer. I understood the warranty was expired this time. I've had them replaced before. The company I deal with, I like them because of their warranty policy. They will replace a boat if you break in the year. This one, however, was out of warranty. So that's on me. I fixed it last night. Did a little bit of plastic welding, and you'll see it on my car soon. It's got this big patch on it from where I fixed it. Well, it's never going to be the same. It's going to break again. Eventually, I'm just going to have to replace it. So the ones I've had replaced by the manufacturer always asks me not to attempt to fix it until I've clearly documented and they have given verbal consent that they are ready for me to fix it. Fair enough. That's their policy. Finally, they ask that I go through the seller, which in the first go-round was Headwaters Outfitters in Rosman. And the second go-around was Appomattox Paddle Sports in Virginia. So in both cases, I had to contact the seller directly, talk to them on the phone, and say, hey, Tom from Appomattox Paddle Sports broke a kayak again. He's like, really, again? So he's like, okay, how'd this happen, blah, blah, blah. We go through the rigmarole, I document everything, and they finally fix it. So that's on me to have to do that. And then I keep a record of my attempts. I can show you this Google Drive folder of all of the records of all of the emails of these transactions. Because after all, companies are obligated to make it right if that's what their warranty policy is. But sometimes they're going to play the I forgot about it game. Sometimes they're going to drag their feet. And that's a technique on them to try to get out of this. Maybe you'll forget about it. Maybe you'll leave it alone. And finally, all of these communications, I have records of. And this is just something about the warranty process. So, consumer responsibilities, hopefully it makes sense. Okay, so you're going to buy something. That's exciting. It costs more than money to buy something. Money is the representative of your effort, of your time. Part of your life is now translated to that money. And so you're going to spend part of your life on something. It's weird when you think about it that way. What does that mean? That means that there are factors involved in consumers' decision. Since we have scarce resources, then we have to deal with the income that we have and the limited time that we have. So, into buying something. Number one, you have to decide. Do you want the thing? Great. What do you know about the thing? I mean, as a parent, I will be telling my kid this. Okay, you want the toy. That's awesome. What do you know about the toy? Okay, is it what you've always wanted? Is it fun? Is this going to be just something you'll buy and be bored with? Okay, you really want the toy. Great. What are you going to have to do to get the toy? Does this mean chores? Like, how many weeks of chores are you going to have to save up for? You know, we're going to do some kind of allowance thing. And so, okay, you're willing to save up for weeks and weeks and weeks. That's what you really want? Okay, that's what you really want. I went through this with my parents with my first Lego castle. I still have that castle. It is still assembled. And I put it together in 1990, and it is still assembled in my attic. And I'm actually going to bring and put it in here now that I'm having kids. So you'll see a Lego castle appear there. I put that thing together in the late 80s. Because I saved up an entire summer and worked my tail off as a kid in the late 80s to get that Lego castle. And because that meant so much to me that I had to work so hard to earn that thing, I still have it. Finally, it's an opportunity cost involved in any decision. So hopefully you know a little more about the process now.